Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a proposed solar farm in Wayne County is sparking debate among residents, farmers, and environmental advocates. As Pennsylvania pushes for more renewable energy, questions remain about land use, community impact, and the future of large-scale solar development. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar reports. Millions of dollars from a major environmental pollution settlement are now headed to farms in Delaware and Sullivan counties. We'll hear how local farmers will use the funding to improve soil health and invest in new agricultural technology. Plus, a new trail on Walnut Mountain in Sullivan County is connecting hikers with a forgotten chapter of Liberty history. And local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. It's coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Libby Casey. Israel's military is making its deepest push into southern Lebanon in decades, despite an official ceasefire in the war with Hezbollah. Israel also says it captured a medieval castle over the weekend, and now the country's leader has ordered airstrikes on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Here's NPR's Greg Myrie.
An Israeli flag now flies over Beaufort Castle, a 12th-century hilltop structure with a commanding view of southern Lebanon. The Israelis say the militant group Hezbollah was using the area to fire on nearby northern Israel. Israeli troops keep expanding their ground operations. It now appears to be the largest such offensive since Israel withdrew from southern Lebanon back in 2000. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also ordered the military to bomb Hezbollah strongholds in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Hezbollah is backed by Iran, which says any efforts to end the U.S.-Iran war must also include plans to stop the fighting in Lebanon. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks opened mixed this morning as crude oil prices rose. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 125 points in early trading.
An exchange of attacks between the U.S. and Iran pushed crude oil prices up slightly. Retail gasoline prices continue to fall, however. AAA says the average price of regular gas is now $4.32 a gallon. That's down about 18 cents from a week ago. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell acknowledged that the central bank makes mistakes and sometimes has to change course, but Powell says the Fed acts only in response to its economic analysis, not political pressure. Powell spoke in Boston last night, where he accepted the Profile in Courage Award from the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation. Asian stocks were mostly up overnight, with indexes in Tokyo and Seoul closing at record highs. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Atlantic hurricane season begins today. NPR's Julia Simon reports forecasters are predicting a below-average number of named storms.
Last month, forecasters with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said they expected this year's Atlantic hurricane season to be relatively quiet. NOAA is predicting 3 to 6 hurricanes, while 7 is the average annual number. That's in large part because the El Niño weather pattern will likely emerge this year. El Niños typically increase the strong winds that can tear apart developing storms. But while the Atlantic region may catch a break this year, the Eastern Pacific could face more storms. And the Federal Emergency Management Agency is going into this hurricane season with far less staff. Julia Simon, NPR News.
Congress returns to Washington today. Republicans are pushing funding for immigration enforcement, and Democrats are focused on President Trump's fund for people he says have been victimized by the U.S. government. This is NPR News. There's big news in cancer treatments. A new drug is proving much more effective than standard chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
The data is from a phase 3 clinical study on a drug called daraxonrasib. It's a breakthrough in that it locks into pancreatic cancer cells in a clever way when certain genetic mutations are present. Julie Grelo is chief medical officer at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, which publishes the most promising research during its annual meeting. She called the drug
the most innovative in terms of a new drug strategy and important in terms of immediately changing practice and offering a lot of hope.
Though it is not yet Food and Drug Administration approved, the agency has already expanded early patient access to it. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Businesses have started receiving funds after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that President Trump improperly imposed some tariffs on imported goods, but the Trump administration says it will appeal a federal judge's order making all companies that paid duties eligible for refunds, not just the ones that filed lawsuits. The French Navy has intercepted another Russia-linked oil tanker under international sanctions. French President Emmanuel Macron announced Sunday's interception of the vessel, the Taygor, in the Atlantic. Officials say France worked with allies, including the United Kingdom. They're trying to stop tankers from skirting sanctions slapped on Russia because of its war against Ukraine. This is NPR News, live in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. A proposed utility-scale solar facility in Wayne County, Pennsylvania, is drawing mixed reactions from residents and environmental advocates. The proposal includes building over 36,000 solar panels across Damascus and Oregon townships. Similar debates about large-scale solar projects are happening across the country as states try to balance responsible development and clean energy goals. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar reports.
Along Amy Road in Damascus, Pennsylvania, sprawling fields of yellow wildflowers overlook the rolling terrain. Tim Dennis has owned a butcher shop just off the dirt road for 15 years. He says he loves the people that make the area feel like home.
This area has a rich history of farms. There are still active farms around here. Right across from my butcher shop, there's the Lukens Farm. They have beef animals. Just up the road on Calkins Road is the Bryant Farm. There's a creamery there also.
And it's here where a developer wants to build an 18-megawatt solar energy facility in Wayne County. The project would border Oregon and Damascus townships on about 103 acres of land. The developer, WA Coschecton II LLC, owned by Ampliform, says the utility-scale project could generate enough electricity to power about 3,000 homes each year. But Dennis strongly opposes the plan. He says it would change the landscape and fabric of the community for good.
It would affect the rural residential. It's not, this type of stuff is not meant to be rural residential. These are farmland fields that have been hayed forever and farmed forever and are still being farmed, but that will no longer happen and be the case with it complete solar field. And there's 36,500 solar panels proposed.
Pennsylvania has been aggressively trying to increase its renewable energy production over the years. Dennis says he's not opposed to solar and renewable energy. He knows it's important for the state. But where it goes is an important part of the equation.
The reason that there's proposing this out in the country is because they get less opposition. There's only a few landowners that it's going to affect. And they're all against it also.
Pennsylvania has long relied on fossil fuels to power its energy through coal, natural gas, and oil. The state is the third largest energy supplier to other states in the country. But its heavy reliance on fossil fuels wasn't always the case. The state was once considered a leader in renewable energy in the early 2000s and was one of the earliest adapters to mandate alternative energy standards. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro pledged a 30 by 30 campaign during his 2024 run for governor that 30% of the energy sold in the state would come from renewable energy. Sharon Pilar is the founder and executive director at the Pennsylvania Solar Center. She says the state's rollout has been slow.
We were one of the first states to have these portfolio standards, and then we fell way behind. And that's still our policy. We've surpassed that goal. And now we're really the worst state in the whole Eastern Corridor as far as per capita amount of solar. So that's kind of where we are right now.
To go from kind of being one of the leaders when it comes to renewable energy to kind of falling so far behind, like what happened in between those years?
Well, mostly it's a political problem, a big energy state. You know, we always have been first oil, then coal, and now natural gas. Pennsylvania has that mindset, that worldview around fossil fuels, and they have dominated our political atmosphere too. And that's been the major problem in Pennsylvania, to move renewables forward, even while the rest of the world sees that as the cheapest, fastest way to build new energy.
Barbara Arundel is the director of Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, an environmental advocacy nonprofit in Pennsylvania. She says solar farms aren't perfect, but they're necessary as electricity costs skyrocket.
Demand for electricity, certainly in this country, is increasing and is proposed to continue increasing. And if the supply doesn't increase, two things will happen. The prices will go up and the grids will become unstable. So we need additional supply, and that can be provided by either renewables, which are the most cost-effective way to generate electricity, or fossil fuels. And fossil fuels cause global warming, environmental destruction, geopolitical instability, and more and more. And renewables, well, they're not perfect, but by far way better to generate electricity. And better is better.
Arundel says solar projects have to be planned with care and caution to minimize any dangers to homes and the environment.
If it's not regulated properly, you can have damage from clear cutting, from herbicide use to prevent plants from growing underneath it. You can have runoff problems and so forth. But it really sounds like there's a pretty good grasp of what safe requirements are needed by the conditional use requirements.
Wayne County isn't alone in this fight. Similar debates around building large-scale solar is playing out in communities across the country as states try to balance responsible development and their clean energy goals. But Bill Shaughnessy says this proposed solar project, which would cost about $33 million, just doesn't meet Pennsylvania standards. He's one of the homeowners whose properties would be affected by the project. His grandparents started coming up to Northeast Pennsylvania in the 1940s. And by 1971, they bought a home full-time.
It's a beautiful piece of land. It's like 230 acres, you know, with streams and ponds and eagles and otters and you name it. It's all running around up there. So, you know, as a kid, I would go, my grandparents had a place there. And every weekend, I couldn't wait to go up to my Nana and Pop's place and, you know, stay there for the weekend and just run around those woods. I those woods like the back of my hand because I literally grew up in them.
To construct the project, landowners would have to lease a portion of their land to the developer. But so far, Shaughnessy says the majority of residents have rejected the lease offer. Like Dennis, Shaughnessy says he recognizes the state's need for renewable energy. But he and others strongly oppose the plan for a number of reasons, he says. Depreciation of property value, poor planning, stormwater runoff, and most importantly, its impact on the environment.
Solar field in that particular area is not environmentally sound at all. And it actually sits at the headwaters of a protected stream, which flows right down to the Calkins Creek and eventually into the Delaware. And there's a lot of questions with that, not the least of which is the wildlife. I have eagles. All of our neighbors have eagles. There's actually eagle nests on some of the neighbors' property. They roost in the trees on my property. They roost in the trees where they're going to be cutting for these solar panels. I have a big problem with that.
At a conditional use hearing on May 20th in Damascus, residents packed the town's municipal building with others waiting to get inside. Residents raised similar concerns to Shaughnessy, notably the amount of trees and woodlands that would have to be cleared for the project. Zoning ordinances in Damascus says the project can remove no more than 25% of trees or woodlands on the project's property. But residents allege that the amount is actually much more than that, and that developers are combining Oregon and Damascus township acreage to meet the requirement. Plus, the proposed area has wetlands, lots of them. The developer identified about 11 wetlands on about 43 acres of the project area. Now the project heads to the township's board of supervisor. Ed LeGarin, zoning officer for Damascus Township, says supervisors have until mid-July, or 45 days since the project's May conditional use hearing, to decide if they want to approve or deny a conditional use.
The next step would be a land development plan, which I have to... They have to do all their NPDES, would be secret over in New York, where they have to account for every bit of water that hits the property. How are they going to deal with it?
Okay.
How's it going to run off? What are the effects on wildlife, vegetation, those kinds of things? And afterwards, for maintaining it so that it doesn't erode and create problems in the water system.
Sarah Dunn is the Pennsylvania Rural Organizing Associate for Solar United Neighbors. She says she often sees rural Pennsylvanians pushing back against some of the solar arrays, part of it due to misinformation.
My heart can imagine where that's coming from, is the reality that Pennsylvania in the past has been such a leader in energy production, whether it was coal or natural gas, and at various points in time throughout that history, our rural communities here in the state have unfortunately seen some negative ramifications of extractive energy, whether that be land use or community health, health of families, et cetera. And so some of the things that I really want to communicate to my neighbors and to other Pennsylvanians is that solar works for us on so many levels. Solar works for our farmers, which is front and center in rural communities. It allows farmers to keep their land in their families, especially when there are financial hardships. We are finding that it allows them to pass it down to the next generation. We are finding that it allows farmers to diversify their agricultural portfolio, so to speak.
Some critics say that solar projects should prioritize going on rooftops and warehouses rather than valuable farmland and wildlife habitat. But Dunn argues that isn't enough.
But the reality is that we need, at this point, we need more power on the grid than just what our rooftops can allow. And unfortunately, with a lack of incentives right now to go solar, it's making it more difficult for individual households to go solar at this time.
It doesn't look like solar is going anywhere. In fact, most agree that it'll likely increase. But where the projects go and how it's built remain an open question, says Shaughnessy.
Solar farms are going to be popping up a lot. And I think we do have to be responsible when these things are planned out and where they go, not just because it's close to a power line, there's a lot of acreage. They really need to look at a lot of other things there, too.
In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Coming up, we speak with the Watershed Agricultural Council about more than $1.3 million in grants awarded to 25 local farms. It's part of a settlement tied to environmental violations at a Delaware County facility. That's next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Tavern on Main, where modern American cuisine meets classic favorites. Dinner, weekend brunch, craft cocktails, and warm hospitality on Main Street in Jeffersonville. More at tavernonmainny.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we revisit a series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York Attorney General Letitia James and the state's DEC have awarded more than $1.34 million in grants to Delaware and Sullivan County farmers. The grant program is a result of the 2023 illegal pollution settlement with Friesland for their repeated environmental law violations at their facility in Delhi. The grants will focus on access to new agricultural technology and improving soil health for 25 farms, including dairy, cattle, and organic crop farms. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar spoke with Connor Young, Agricultural Program Manager at the Watershed Agricultural Council, for more.
This grant program was essentially funded by this 2023 settlement with Friesland in Delaware County. Let's start with why this grant program was established in the first place.
Sure, yeah. I think the New York State Office of the Attorney General, I think they were really invested in seeing these funds be redistributed into the community from, from where the original offense occurred. And in collaboration with New York State DEC, agriculture was clearly one of the, one of the leading areas that was relevant to the company itself, as well as to the air and water quality violations that were settled. So we were able to collaborate, work together, and identify this grant opportunity to effectively distribute those funds to the farming community in the area of, predominantly Delaware County, but, the New York City watershed generally.
And about roughly, two dozen farms in Delaware and Sullivan counties will receive these grant funds. Can you talk a little bit just more broadly about who encompasses these farms and kind of what that selection process was like?
Yeah, sure. So the Watershed Ag Council has been a part of the, agricultural community for over 30 years now. And it's really it's a 501c3 nonprofit organization, but that partners with both New York City and a longstanding voluntary partnership with the farmers who are, we're looking to balance both environmental stewardship, water quality protection, with economic viability. And so we have an established participant base of over 200 farms that voluntarily, engage in this program and do things as whole farm planning and nutrient management planning for manure application. We do structural and agronomic best management practice design and implementation, precision feed management. We have a robust farmer education program as well. So when these opportunities arise, there is a built-in community that is pretty well aware of, what might be on the cutting edge of what they can pursue. And so these farmers range from organic, intensive, smaller scale vegetable farms to, at least for this region, somewhat larger dairy operations. We have a lot of beef rotational grazing systems, mm-hmm. and all farms are represented in the group that not only applied but were awarded to.
And the funded projects fall into kind of like three categories. There's this innovative equipment, soil health and cover crop management, and then agricultural drones. Why such a focus on these three particular areas?
Well, I think there's an incredible opportunity for technological advancement and farm efficiency while also supporting positive benefits in an environmental sense. But they range in price, they range in accessibility, as well as adoptability. And so really, this is a demonstration program with education and knowledge sharing at its core. And so working with the Office of Attorney General, we were able to identify areas that were accessible that could still be diversified. So all three categories represent known areas of potential improvement that farmers are interested in and want to explore, because farmers at the end of the day are the ones that are taking the risk to try this, to educate their neighbors and be the first ones through the gate on a small scale system, with this equipment, this technology, these systems with their animals, with their tractors, their implements. And so this grant really mitigates the risk of that financial decision, and then also aids in future farming decisions for others to determine whether or not it will be a good fit for them.
And Connor, you're the agricultural program manager at the Watershed Ag Council. You talked a little bit about this already, but I'd love to just hear a little bit more about what you're hearing from farmers in the region about the challenges they're facing right now and how you think that this grant funding can address that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, where do you start? There are some of these are evolving challenges that can fluctuate with any number of variables that come and go year to year. Right now, it seems particularly hard, whether that's fuel prices, access to certain, you know, materials or even products that are necessary for what it would a routine, you know, production year might look like. You throw in climate change impacts, flooding, drought, and you get these long-term patterns, and farmers are trying to build resilience. And I mean, those really do range from whether or not we can safely and effectively implement like a spring crop all the way to the overarching season production value. So these grants are really meant to facilitate innovation, of course, education, but farm efficiency while also achieving an environmental goal. So some of the projects include grazing collars, where farmers in the Catskills have ample access to grass. However, fencing these areas, there are a lot of hillsides. They're not ideal for a cropping system. However, animals can access them. They may have like pretty great water sources. So collars are going to be really worth exploring to see how much more rotational grazing access can a farmer capitalize on in a drought by using their phone to set up new fence lines. Will the animals have access to fresher forage more consistently? Will they be able to access areas they previously couldn't? That not only might decrease the infrastructure requirements, but the maintenance of it, as well as the time, fuel, and just labor, which may or may not even be available to begin with, to rotate animals on a routine basis. That, as one example, could be a game changer for farms in this area.
Yeah, we've been reporting on the most recent frost that happened, I believe, in April, and a lot of the apple farms, their crops were hit. And one of the farmers I was chatting with was talking about using agricultural drones, you know, to assist with preventing that crop loss. And I'm curious, you know, from your role, are you seeing more farmers be receptive to some of this newer technology?
Yeah, I mean, we had a really competitive grant process. This was not we certainly got a lot more proposals than we were able to fund. And the ideas were amazing. They were very creative. They were all over the map in terms of opportunity. The drones specifically, there's a number, like there was capped at 3 drone purchases total. So 3 farms were awarded that, where they'll become an agricultural pilot. And they'll be able to explore how can they more efficiently tackle invasive species in their pasture systems? How can they introduce cover crop seed into standing row crops, you know, thereby decreasing the risk we see in the fall to have that, you know, continuous vegetative cover to prevent erosion, to build soil health, along with more efficient herbicide or fungicide application. Is there a way that we can actually reduce the amount of herbicide even necessary, as well as the compaction of soil, the equipment and fuel hours, the depreciation on that equipment and the labor? These are all things we're going to be exploring. And luckily we're fortunate to have Cornell Farmers Data Lab be a partner on this, where we're going to be working together to identify what the farmer wants to learn. Mm-hmm. How can we effectively, you know, monitor and measure the impacts of this equipment on this scale, and then have that all come together to give a fuller picture for farmers across the state and the region?
I am just curious, you know, was there kind of like an average grant size for these grants, or do they vary from project to project?
They vary from project to project. So in all 3 categories, they each had a cap for funding that was available on a per project basis, as well as a funding amount that was, you know, dedicated to that area. So that first category of soil health and cover crop management, most of those technologies are not necessarily brand new. Some of them may be relatively new for this area, but a lot of farms may have experimented with those. So we wanted to see meaningful steps forward for the individual farm that could also show new or, you know, impactful uses of equipment that may be more familiar. So that was capped at a $200,000 overall with a $50,000 project cap. The drones was slightly different. That was, we had custom service opportunities, which was capped at $50,000 as well, but you had to have a minimum of 100 acres over the grant term of 3 years to be able to experiment with that. And then the drone purchases were $50,000 caps maxed at 3. And then that final category you mentioned earlier for the innovative technology, that was far more wide open. and all remaining funds from the, you know, the $1.35 million was dedicated to that. And that was a $75,000 cap. And we had projects as small as just shy of $10,000 all the way to the $75,000 cap.
Well, Connor, before we sign off, you know, I know that Attorney General Letitia James announced these grants. Before we sign off, do you want to just share kind of what the next steps and timeline is going to look like?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know I said it before, but we're really grateful to be working with the Attorney General's office and especially, you know, with Attorney General James and Commissioner Lefton and their support of this idea and seeing it through. It's been a great opportunity. And for next steps, we are just trying to get rolling with equipment purchases and getting these farms rolling, you know, just getting the technology on the ground and starting to do field studies and determine our evaluation metrics and goals. And so on an annual basis, we'll likely be doing a tour that'll be more public facing. That'll be selecting a few farms each year to be able to showcase what they have going on so they can also share their personal experience with the technology that they're trialing. And then we'll also be producing, you know, more public facing social media posts, as well as a white paper and summary profiles of each project that can be shared widely and over time. So yeah, there's a lot more to come, and we're really excited about it.
We've been chatting with Connor Young, Agricultural Program Manager at the Watershed Agricultural Council. Connor, thank you again so much for chatting.
Yeah, Kim, thank you.
And coming up, the latest economic news from our local economist and author, James B. Huntington. It's Radio Chatskill.
NEPA Give starts on June 4th at 7 p.m. Show your support for Radio Catskill and other great nonprofit organizations serving Northeast Pennsylvania. You have just 24 hours to give, from June 4th at 7 p.m. to June 5th at 7 p.m., so be sure to make your donation on time. You don't need a Pennsylvania zip code to donate, and every donation gets Radio Catskill closer to its $2,500 goal. Donate to Radio Catskill before 7 p.m. Friday at nepagives.com.
Across Africa, U.S. funding of HIV/AIDS programs is being changed dramatically. And in Mozambique, doctors are battling the disease alongside big infrastructure challenges, like access to electricity and water.
Water and power are still struggling in the country. It's still a huge problem.
I'm Juana Summers, the fragile state of Mozambique's AIDS treatment, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill, and it's a Monday, working 9 to 5, which means we get to check in with our own James B. Huntington for Local Economic Perspective. James B., welcome.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, there's a new Fed chair, but there's nothing new happening with the Fed's preferred measure of inflation. What happened with that inflation gauge last week for the Fed?
Yes, this is the personal consumption expenditures index. It rose 3.8% from the same time last year. That's the same as the previous week's related inflation measure. It's 3.3% only if we strip out the volatile food and energy prices. That also notched a multi-year high, though, so it's too high. It's getting to look a lot higher. Exactly how much influence is going to be from gas prices and oil and such from what's going on around Iran, we don't know, but it's up considerably, and now there's talk from replacing the idea of lowering interest rates with raising them, because that's really what's going on. That could well be indicated. A lot is going to tell when we see next month's report, if it is continuing to have more effect on the economy in general, on inflation, what's happening with oil, or it will not. So we'll hold off and see, but yeah, so it's, but with talk about rates needing to rise to get inflation under control, that's a real thing that could happen within the next couple of months.
Yeah, and that new Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, sworn into his role last week. He'll oversee the next monetary policy meeting in mid-June. It'll be interesting to see what happens there, as the pain is really real for many Americans right now.
Yes, well, there's a lot of people who are strapped to pay their gas bills, people who have lower income but end up with large commutes and such. It's hurting people in that category a great deal.
Another place where the folks are feeling pain is some 2026 graduates. They're struggling to find jobs. You were pointing out that some 1991 graduates have some advice for those graduating this year.
Yes, well, we're getting to the point where some of these things are patterns, where we've had a lot of years with poor job prospects for new graduates. So we're getting parent-child combinations where the parent saw the same thing back then. So the advice we're getting, we're really seeing, is to keep trying, not give up, to look for something, even if you don't think it's very well suited. There was a good example here about somebody who wound up becoming a secretary at Rutgers, a university, and it was not what she wanted to do at all, but it led to other jobs in the field she wanted. And now she's a communications executive. So it's still true that if you have good credentials and you work hard, you can get ahead from rather ordinary jobs. So we have a lot of people who are experiencing these things, and their stories look awfully similar. So hang on, keep trying. It does get better, was one piece of constant advice. If you get one break, even if it takes a year instead of a few months or whatever you were expecting, you may be able to parlay that into something much better. So hang on. These are not new times as far as what people are needing to do.
Also, it looks like teens and their summer gigs are getting harder to come by as fewer employers hire seasonal workers. Where can teens still find work this summer? What categories?
It's really pretty awful here. They're saying it's at the lowest level for what they call teen hiring, people between 16 and 19, supposedly only for summers, the lowest level in nearly 80 years of Bureau of Labor Statistics data. The kind of places we're seeing, the kind of things we're seeing are good, that are relatively good: lifeguards, shelf stockers, camp counselors, restaurant hosts and servers are still good. Other opportunities within retail and hospitality, some of these things, they regularly need people. So there are opportunities out there. They may be different, or they might not be what you expected, but there are still some possibilities. And obviously, get out there now that we're June. They're looking to fill positions as quickly as they can. Even if you have a couple of weeks or so of high school to go, try breaking out and applying for some jobs. It may make a difference.
Yeah, they're just going to be a little bit more competitive, it seems. Let's shift over to union density. That's the share of employees in the U.S. who are covered by or a member of a union. What's been happening with union density in the U.S.?
Well, we have some real changes here. It's been declining. There have been fewer union members in jobs where there are union workers. One reason for that is there are more right-to-work states where the law does not allow unions to take dues from people who are not union members. That's often the case where even if they're not union members, they have to pay dues, but it's not true in right-to-work states. So in those states, you get fewer union members. Even public sector jobs, which have had much of the growth in unions over the last decade or so, are decreasing now in terms of number of people. Second, most union members do carry over from year to year. It's not a lot of people coming and going. It's mainly people staying. So we're really about two-thirds or more of union members in a year were in the same union over the previous year. Third, they are retiring more early. That sounds like another variable that snuck in there on this one. Perhaps union members are older on average than non-union members, but that is something that's coming out statistically. We have right-to-work states having fewer private sector union members and union density, and it's explained by a lot of different factors. Other things are that there are often not as much union organizing going on. There's expansions of social insurance, which decreases people's interest in being in unions, and competition from imports. All these things have been factors, but there's getting to be less of it. Though, if we have employers misbehaving, as we had in some cases like Starbucks, where they were not cooperating with employees at all, then there's still a good chance they'll want to unionize. So expect more in some places, but probably less in general.
One area that's not going to be able to unionize is the latest spooky invasion of AI. What is going on at LaGuardia Airport with this hologram concierge?
Yes, well, they have a hologram that of a person that acts like a person.
Like a life-size person.
Yes, really, a lifetime person. It's at LaGuardia, and it's called Bridget. And it or she responds to travelers' questions conversationally. Instead of being all pre-recorded, they will answer questions so they can give directions to things like gates and baggage claim and lounges and shops and other information. So try it out if you see it. It may be sort of midway between people and, say, computer kiosks mm-hmm. or something. It may turn out to work very well. And if it works out at LaGuardia, they certainly will appear in other places as well.
Yeah, I guess we're used to those sort of personal assistants on your phone or in your home, but like this is a sort of life-size version of that on a screen that's reacting in real time. So hence my description of it as spooky, I guess.
Yeah, I don't even know if it has a screen. It may just be a projection
uh-huh.
in an open space that comes from the ceiling.
Yikes. All right. I'm not going to Terminal B at LaGuardia, I think. Okay, let's talk about the latest prices, stock, oil, precious metal, crypto. How did things change, and what were they like this morning?
Okay, as of early this morning, and these are two-week changes, we have gold, $44.92 the ounce. That's down $54, a relative low. The inflation hedge doesn't seem to be working as strongly. I don't know why not, but it isn't. Silver is staying along with gold, 75.41, down 39 cents. The ratio there is 59.5. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 51,032, up 1,500 over the past 2 weeks for an all-time high or close to it. It's being driven really by AI financials that came in that were very good, which has got a lot of encouragement that money really is being made, not only from the people supplying the equipment, but people making AI products in particular. And that is a change that has not always been the case. NASDAQ did much the same, equivalent 26,973, up 748. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 91.02 the barrel, down $15. Well, we've had sort of two prices over the last few months. We have the 106, 107-ish, meaning the war is getting hot in Iran, and then we have the 91 or the low 90s or high 80s where there is not as much combat going on. So, yeah, will it last? Who knows? We might well see 106 next week, depending on what happens out there. Bitcoin, 72,638. That's down 4,200. In 3 weeks, it's been down over 8,000, fluctuating. I think somehow it may be related to gold, where the gold, if gold, people don't care about safety, that sort of safety, then they won't care about Bitcoin. They won't be as interested in investing in that either. British pound, 1.3467, up about a penny. Surprising. There's some story here, but I don't know what it is. Euro, 1.1656, up 19 hundredths of a cent. Nothing much happened there, and nothing at all happened with the Japanese 100 yen coin, still at 63 cents, sitting at the bottom of its range. So overall, we have a possibility of some real prosperity improvements. We're well positioned to benefit if that Gulf War ends, or at least, or even if there is a real stop in firefights and such there. So enthusiasm may or may not last, and but stocks are responding to more business news, so there's really nothing stopping AI yet. If that happens, we could have some big decreases.
All right, keeping an eye on it is James B. Huntington, a local economist and author, every Monday here at Radio Chatskill. Thank you, James B.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
Coming up, a piece of Liberty's history coming back to life. We'll hear how a pair of winter hikers uncovered the story of a long-lost hotel and how that discovery led to a new history trail opening this weekend. Stay with us. This is Radio Chatskill.
What is it that makes humans human? The answer is complicated.
One of the things I've been most interested over my career is trying to figure out what is actually pan-human and what is just the particular societies that we grow up in.
The surprising ways in which culture shapes our bodies and our minds, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Chatskill. This weekend, the town of Liberty will officially open the new Walnut Mountain House History Trail, giving visitors a chance to explore the former site of a once popular mountaintop resort while learning about its fascinating past. Joining us now are volunteer researchers Lisa Lyon and Ruth Hugler, who helped uncover the hotel's story, Nick Russin from the Town of Liberty Parks and Recreation Department, and Town Supervisor Frank DeMeo. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Tim.
Good morning, Tim.
So, Lisa, Ruth, how did this idea for creating the Walnut Mountain House History Trail first come about?
Because Ruth and I were hiking together, and I learned that she volunteered at the Historical Society and said to her, oh my goodness, I'm going to be coming to see you soon. There's a project that I'd love to work on. And I mentioned what it was, and she said, Walnut Mountain House? There's a photograph you might want to see from my family collection, and it's a stunner. And for all those who will hike this history trail, it is on panel 6. So you're encouraged to hike
to
the top.
Write that down.
That's right.
Ruth, what was the Walnut Mountain House, and why was it so important to Liberty's history?
Well, it was one of the first places that was built on the mountain for a hotel by Mr. Holmes of Ellenville, purchased the property. And in 1886, they started to build it. And obviously for the views at that time, there were very few trees. It had been a property mostly farming. That was the big draw, was the cool air, the beautiful views, and we really wanted to connect this, obviously, to the mountains trails to make it the same sort of venue for people to visit.
And I mentioned you guys did a lot of research here. What were some of the challenges you may have faced in some of that research and just finding the documentation about this long-lost hotel?
So there are colorized postcards that people love to collect. And I would do hikes in snowshoes there for 21 years. And I would say, why doesn't anybody tell me what that foundation is? It's empty foundation at the summit. And in the winter, you have incredible views through the trees without the leaves on. So long story short, we started with colorized postcards. And Ruth and I would hike up there before the leaves popped in the spring. And sometimes in the dead of winter, we'd be up there. Right, Ruth? And we'd be trying to figure out where all those postcard pictures were taken. And that's how it began.
Nick, you know, the town of Liberty has a parks and recreation goals. How does this fit into those goals for you? And what did you think when this pair of enthusiastic hikers came to you guys with the idea?
Well, their enthusiasm is infectious. And I have to say, so I'm actually the confidential secretary to Supervisor DeMeo. So I am not a part of the Parks and Recreation
Department. Oh, I'm sorry. Misunderstood.
And I do help with grant administration and getting grants. So Lisa and Ruth approached the supervisor's office with this idea, and the wealth of knowledge, their research, the depth that they had behind it really made us motivated and really got us engaged. So,
and Frank, it's not like you don't know these two.
Oh, I do. And you know, I'm gonna reflect back because actually it was at a Sullivan 180 function 3 years ago, I think it was, Lisa, right?
Yeah.
And Lisa approached me, and we knew each other, you know, just in passing. But she approached me with this idea, and I was like, sounds really cool. Okay, let's make it happen. And before you know it, we're having our first meeting, and we pretty much met every month for the better part of 3 years. As this project matured, and it's just another great attraction we have in our really special parks in the town of Liberty.
And this is a project that's bringing together local government, volunteers. You've got the community organization, Sullivan 180, you mentioned. What does that collaboration say about Liberty, do you guys think?
Well, I mean, Nick and I are both firm believers in creating partnerships. That's how you get things done. So, you know, by getting all these partners together and having this, I mean, the volunteer work, the work from Melissa Thalman and getting the students together, I mean, it's just an incredible effort and collaboration. And we, Nick and I realized since we've been in this job again that, you know, it's that collaboration and development of partnerships that make projects like this happen. And Just a great team, great, great team. And these two ladies are amazing. It's just, that's all I got
to
say.
They're a force to be reckoned with here.
Absolutely.
Lisa, can you describe the trail itself and what hikers can expect during the 1 mile round trip walk?
Pretend you are on a horse and carriage and it's 1900. And it's a gentle ascent for you to walk on, wide as can be, red shale, beautiful, beautiful world of birds in the forest there. And I don't mean to make it like forested, but it is forested and it's absolutely beautiful. And you gently go uphill and we will have the catch your breath bench, which everyone is encouraged to just say, okay, I'm going to get as far as that darn bench. Where is it? And you relax, catch your breath and continue forward. Right? Isn't that what they're going to do, Nick?
That's the idea.
And then there's an opening celebration coming up. Tell us about that.
Yeah. That Frank, how about you?
Well, the celebration is on Saturday at 10 o'clock, and we'll start at panel one, I guess, right? And and, you know, do the introductions and the recognitions. And then folks are going to head up. There are two options for the trail, one for those who are more aggressive at hiking. I think Lisa's leading that charge. And then Ruth is going to lead the charge for the folks that, you know, want to take their time a little bit more and rest maybe along the way a little bit more. I'm not sure which one I'm going on, but you'll find out on Saturday.
We'll find out the catch my breath. Yeah. I'm kidding.
Stragglers.
And if anyone is interested in attending, it's going to be at the main entrance of Walnut Mountain Park, 73 Walnut Mountain Road.
And where can folks get more information? At the town website?
On the town website, the Town of Liberty Facebook page.
And I want to ask this of each of you, and Nick, we'll start with you. We'll kind of go down the row here. When visitors stand at that summit and look out over the landscape where the Walnut Mountain House was and once welcomed guests, what do you hope they think about in the terms of the history of Liberty and the people that founded this and came before us?
was actually up there yesterday at the summit, and there was 30 student volunteers, over 30 student volunteers there, and what struck me was the connection between our past and this young generation. It was amazing to see them working around the foundation, getting a sense of the history, getting a sense of what came before. It's just great to see people paying homage to Liberty's rich history.
I'm gonna jump over to the supervisor here and ask him the same question.
Yeah, I just think, you know, I'm fascinated by history. I'm fascinated by the history of the area. And I didn't live here, you know, during the heyday of the Borscht Belt and all the hotels and everything. But just to think, I think that this was like, you know, sort of the beginning of that era. And it's just fascinating to see the photographs and, you know, the people that were involved at that time. And just to look at when you look at the postcards and you see open space up there, which is now forested, like Lisa said, and it's hard to imagine, but it's easy to dream about, and it's really just a very cool place.
Ruth, what does that mean for you? What do you hope folks take away from that?
Well, I have the privilege of having grown up across the street from the mountain when I was younger, and so for me, it was a playground. And for the town to have invested in this in the 1960s and make it a recreation place, I'm just overwhelmed and thrilled and happy. And especially to see the intergenerational aspect of it where they were participating the other day. It was great because we really should honor these public lands that we have and just enjoy them. And I hope that that's what this will do.
And Lisa?
I love the fact that I can walk there with families with little kids, and I'm talking little in backpacks, but all the way to my eldest friends. And they will all enjoy the experience of walking there, being in another world, really. And who doesn't love the sound of a horse and carriage? The hooves of the horses. So I encourage people to go back in time. It's a wonderful experience.
That's Lisa Lyons, Ruth Hugler, who helped discover the new trail on Walnut Mountain and researched all of it, and also Nick Russin and Frank DeMaio from the Town of Liberty. And that event is coming up this Saturday. I had to look at the calendar. I was like, wait, that's next weekend. No, it's June. Today's June. So it's this Saturday, June 6th. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
This is Cooper R. Grace, KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Radio Catskill Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. 2 hours of great music, jazz, funk, blues. I got mellow grooves to help you unwind, exciting rhythms to help you cut loose. Join me Tuesday night for the Music Emporium, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected. New York voters can apply for an early mail-in ballot for any reason. The last day to apply by mail or online is June 13th. The last day to apply in person is June 22nd.
All absentee and mail-in ballots must be postmarked by June 23rd or returned in person to the Board of Elections or any poll site by 9 p.m. Election Day. This is Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Sunshine and clouds with a passing shower or two this afternoon. High 66, low 42 tonight. On Point is next.